Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's Friday. Jimmy Akins here with us for both hours, so get ready for a fantastic program. I love when we do Bible questions with Jimmy Akin.
Is that what we're doing today?
Yeah, we're doing Bible questions. Your Bible questions with Jimmy Akin.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was just an open forum.
Oh, Edgar was probably supposed to tell you, and he took the day off so that he wouldn't have to get. We can do open forum if you want, but I got a Bible question with you to start.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of this book that I have in my hand, The Bible is a Catholic Book. I picked that one because I thought it was Bible questions with Jimmy Akin today. Your Bible questions are part of Ask Me Anything, but you can now ask anything you want. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, I came with this Bible question, so I'll open with that while people are getting on the phones. And then we'll see what people have to say. And I looked it up where the verse is. It's in Revelation chapter 7, starting at verse 2. It says, "Then I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, saying, 'Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of God on their foreheads.' 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel." So my question is, who is that? Who or what is this verse talking about?
Well, you've mentioned one of two passages where the 144,000 are mentioned in Revelation, but there is another passage, and we need to read it if we want to get complete data about them. The other passage, so you read the one in Revelation 7. The other one is in Revelation, well, actually, you need to read more than what you read from Revelation 7.
Okay.
So, in Revelation 7, John sees four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds. And then he sees another angel ascending from the rising of the sun with the seal of the living God. And he called out with a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the earth and sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And then he goes through a list of 12 tribes, which is actually not identical to any of the lists of the 12 tribes in the Old Testament. It's a unique one. But he hears about 12,000 people from each of the 12 tribes. So the number 144,000 is 12,000. It's 12 times 12 times 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
But then you need to keep going because we need to read passages in context. And immediately after the listing of the 12,000 from each tribe, he says, "After this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.'" So that's the relevant passage from Revelation 7. Then there's another passage in Revelation 14 where John says this, "Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb." Oh, actually, need to read it in context. Got to back up.
Okay.
In Revelation 13, we meet two very sinister figures, the beast from the sea and the beast from the land. And we're told that the beast from the sea has a number. And the very last verse in chapter 13 says, "This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. So that's the famous number of the beast. Mm-hmm. Then John says, "Then I looked." So right after he sees the number, he's told us about the number of the beast, he says, "Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had the name of his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing their harps, and they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. Those were groups that surrounded God's throne in heaven. No one could learn this that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouths no lie was found, for they are blameless. So that's the data that were given about the 144,000, both in chapter 7 and chapter 14. So we know a number of different things about them. In terms of who they are, there have been a lot of proposals made. I'll start off by giving you two proposals that I think we can demonstrate pretty readily that are false. The first one is the view of the Jehovah's Witness organization. They claim that the 144,000 are a literal group of 144,000 Jehovah's Witnesses, mm-hmm. who will be given a heavenly destiny to rule with Christ from heaven for 1,000 years in the future. And these Jehovah's Witnesses have it revealed to them by God, as this is a form of private revelation, that they are among the 144,000, and they are referred to sometimes as the anointed class of Jehovah's Witnesses, and only they get to go to heaven. All the rest of the saved stay here on earth. So they get to be up in heaven with Jesus.
Oh.
Now, this is a problematic interpretation for multiple reasons. The principal reason, though, is it just is not grounded in the text. You'll notice that the only thing that the anointed class in Jehovah's Witness theology has in common with the 144,000 as they're described in Revelation is the number 144,000. You know, nothing else is literal. They're not literally from the 12 tribes of Israel. They are not literally all male virgins. They presumably, many of them have told a lie at some point in their life, so that is not literal, that they've never told, that no lie is found in their mouths. There's a whole bunch that is not interpreted literally, except for the number 144,000. That's the only thing the Jehovah's Witnesses take literally. And that's a problem. Now, Revelation is not always to be taken literally, but you could approach this text in one of two ways. You could say either all of the details are non-literal, or all of the details are literal. But it's hard to, it's not a consistent position to say, well, this one detail is literal, but everything else is not. There's also no basis in the text for saying God is going to privately reveal to people, or that they're Jehovah's Witnesses as opposed to Jews, because that's another thing they're not taking literally here. And so this is a very problematic interpretation. Another interpretation that is quite problematic is common in dispensational circles in evangelical Protestantism. According to dispensationalists, now they're not doing what the Jehovah's Witnesses do. They don't take just one detail and say that this one detail is literal. Instead, what dispensationalists tend to do is say it's all literal. So these are a group, according to dispensationalists, of exactly 144,000 Jews from 12,000 from each of the Jewish tribes, and they are male virgins. They have not lied and so forth, and they will be active with Christ. They will be active on earth during the tribulation period that is in our future. So before, in our future, but before the millennium, the future millennium that dispensationalists believe in. The problem with this, one of the major problems with this is that the 144,000 are described in Revelation 7 and Revelation 14. And those chapters in Revelation are not plausibly interpreted as applying in the literal sense to our future. The reason is, or among the reasons are, that we're told both at the beginning of Revelation that it is to reveal what will happen soon, and we're also told at the end of Revelation that the book reveals what will happen soon. Now, soon is to be judged from the perspective of John's original audience, which was alive 2,000 years ago. And if you've got a big gulf of 2,000 years, that ain't soon.
Yeah.
You can try to, you know, fidget around that, but the fact is that the Book of Revelation clearly begins in the first century, because in chapters 2 and 3 we have the letters to the seven churches that existed in the first century, but then at the end of the Book of Revelation clearly applies to the eternal order. So somehow we've got to, in Revelation, get from the first century to the eternal order. And we would thus expect that somewhere in the Book of Revelation we ought to encounter a long period of time that would let us bridge the gap between the first century and the future. Well, okay, we do. And it's in chapter 20. Mm-hmm. It's the millennium. And 1,000 is a symbolic number. It doesn't need to be taken literally. It's like when God in the Psalm says the cattle on 1,000 hills are mine. He's not implying that there's 1,001st hill where he doesn't own the animals. He means all of the animals on all of the hills are mine, and that's symbolized by 1,000. Well, in the same way, most Christians throughout history have understood the revelation, have understood the millennium of 1,000 years to be a long period of time that bridges the beginning of Christian history with the bulk of church history, and then we get the future. So there is a period, a long period of time in Revelation that we would be living in right now. That means that the material before chapter 20, including chapters 7 and 14, would apply to the beginning of Christian history, before the millennium arrives. And that means that the 144,000, whatever they are, should have existed in the beginning of Christian history, yeah, either in the first century or the first few centuries. Now, there are other proposals about who they are, but I'll tell you the one that I tend to prefer.
Okay.
You'll notice that I'll point out two things. The first one is a clue in Revelation 7. And in Revelation 7, we first hear about them before we even hear the number of the 144,000. We first hear about them when that angel from the sunrise says, and I'll get the exact quote here, he says, "Do not harm the earth or the seas or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God." Okay, we're then going to later find out that the servants of our God that get sealed are the 144,000. But if you just read the book in literary order, you know, you come to our first identification of this group of people, and they are called the servants of our God. So, Sykelet, if you're reading a Christian book and it refers to a group known as the servants of our God, yeah, who's it probably talking about?
Christians.
Yeah, all of them.
Yeah.
And yeah, then we notice that after we have this enumeration of 12,000 from each tribe of Israel, by the way, is there any connection between the number 12 and the Christian community in the first century that you can think of, Sykelet? I mean, Israel had 12 patriarchs. Did Jesus maybe appoint anybody that kind of corresponds to 12 patriarchs?
I can think of one group, those apostles.
Yeah, the 12 apostles. Okay, so then we go through the listing of 12,000 from each tribe, and then we get to that verse I wanted us to read, where John says, "After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." So this great multitude that no one can number, that's clearly the worldwide Christian community. So here in Revelation 7, we have the 144,000 identified first as the servants of our God, which John hears about, and then he turns, after he hears about the people who are sealed, he then turns and looks and sees an innumerable multitude. So the description of the 12,000 from each tribe is sandwiched between these two descriptions of the servants of our God and the innumerable multitude of Christians. Now, why is that significant? Well, if you go back to Revelation chapter 5, we find God before the throne in heaven, and he says, in the right hand of the one seated on the throne, that is God, he sees a scroll written within and on the back, so it's what's known as an epistograph. It's a scroll with writing on both sides, sealed with seven seals. And an angel says, who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals? And nobody is found who's like that, and John starts to weep because no one is found worthy to open the scroll. But then one of the elders around the throne of God tells him, weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. So John has just heard about the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So John might expect to see a lion, a conquering beast, you know, a really violent animal. But instead, he says that, and after being told about the Lion of Judah, he looks and says, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain. So instead of a vicious predator, John sees an herbivore that has itself been killed.
Yeah.
And yet everybody recognizes that the Lion of Judah and the lamb that has been slain are both Jesus Christ. So you have this violent imagery associated with Jesus's conquering imagery that's then associated with Jesus's passive nature. The way he conquers is through the cross. So notice John first hears about this figure, then he sees the figure, and it's something surprising.
Yeah.
And that's what we have going on in Revelation 7. First, he hears about the 12,000 from each tribe of Israel. Then he looks and sees the innumerable multitude. And so a great many scholars, and I would be one of the people who support this position, have concluded that the 144,000 are, in fact, the innumerable multitude and the servants of our God in general, the same way that that Jesus Christ is both the lion that John hears about and the lamb that he sees.
Wow, Jimmy, thank you so much. I did not expect to get all that from you. Thank you very much for that. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We better take a break, and we will come right back with lots of questions. Two lines open, 888-318-7884.
Catch Catholic Answers live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Check out EW10's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Jimmy Akin, our guest, and still one line open. So go ahead and get on that line if you've got a question for Jimmy. 888-318-7884. It being Friday, a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World dropped today. A new one drops each Friday. A new episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast drops each Monday. What do we get today, Jimmy?
Well, today we got a Bible mystery. Today I look at the Nephilim, who are mentioned in Genesis chapter 6 and also in Numbers chapter 13, and I talk about what they are. In particular, I look at the theories of Zechariah Sitchin, who claimed that they were aliens from the planet Nibiru, which I conclude is utterly without foundation. Instead, I go through evidence both from the biblical texts and from other ancient Near Eastern texts and show what the Nephilim were. And I also point to a pair of verses in the book of Jude whose significance I only realized recently, that I think makes the interpretation I offer of the Nephilim basically, and their fathers, the sons of God, basically certain.
Oh, very good. All right, check it out at mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcasts, or at Jimmy Akin's channel on YouTube. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. All right, to the phones we go. Let's see. Who do we got? Ryan in Midland, Texas, starting us out today. Hey, welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks for taking my call, guys. Now, Jimmy, I actually have a very short two-part Bible question for you. Mm-hmm. Now, when St. Peter in the Synoptic Confession narrative says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," Would it be a stretch or not to say that St. Peter was familiar with the two powers in heaven concept?
He may well have been. It certainly Jesus was familiar with the two powers in heaven concept. I should explain what that is for people who may not be aware. The two powers in heaven doctrine is a view that was around in early Judaism, including in Jesus's day, that looked at various texts in the Old Testament where you have a reference to an individual that is like God and is even referred to as God, but yet is somehow distinct from God, such as, for example, the angel of the Lord, who in various passages is identified as the angel of the Lord, which would suggest he's distinct from God, but in other passages seems to just speak as God, and it will say, "God said," even though it's the angel of the Lord. So there's a distinction from God, but there's also an identification with God. We see a similar thing happening in the book of Daniel, when Jesus sees God in heaven on his throne, and then riding on a cloud comes one like a son of man. And this son of man figure, because he rides the clouds, that's something that God does, was also seen by some Jews as a divine figure in heaven who is nevertheless distinct somehow from God. And so, again, we have a distinction from God, but an identification with God. And so this is what the second figure is sometimes called the lesser Yahweh or the little Yahweh or the second Yahweh. distinct from the first main primary Yahweh. And Jesus himself quotes from the Daniel passage when he's in front of the high priest, where the high priest says, if you're the Christ, tell us plainly. And Jesus says, I am, and from now on, you will see the Son of Man come in with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest recognizes he's claiming to be a divine figure, and that's what prompt, because it wasn't a crime to claim to be the Messiah. The high priest does regard it as a crime for Jesus to claim to be a divine entity, and that's why he tears his clothes and says, you've heard the blasphemy, why do we need any more witnesses? So Jesus clearly is aware of the two powers in heaven concept. He even alludes to it in the Gospels, and it wouldn't be unreasonable to propose that Peter, as one of Jesus' disciples, also had exposure to this concept, although that is more speculative.
Okay, Ryan?
Sure. The second part is, would I be right or wrong in saying Mark and John were saving story space in their Gospels by not having a Matthew and Luke-style short and long nativity narrative other than John's "and the Word was made flesh" statement?
Well, John is definitely saving space in his gospel by omitting things that the synoptic gospels mention. Mark's case is a little different, and we'll talk about that on the other side of the break.
Hang on, Ryan, because this is the hard break. We got to take it. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Two lines open, 888-318-7884. Right back with more on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. A little bit of groovy music for you there. Jimmy Akin, our guest. On the line, Ryan in Midland, Texas, with a couple questions. And his second has to do with the Gospels of Mark and John. Did they save space by leaving out the infancy narratives that we find in Matthew and Luke?
Yeah, so John is aware of the Synoptic Gospels. At least he's aware of Mark, and there's a very good probability that he's aware of Luke. Some people also argue he was aware of Matthew, and I'm open to the idea he did. I just haven't yet seen evidence that would convince me of that. But John is clearly aware of the synoptic tradition, at least of two of the synoptic gospels, maybe of all three. And he is interested in saving space in his own gospel. he alludes to the need to do this towards the end of the gospel, where he says, I suppose, you know, Jesus did many things, and if I wrote all of them, I suppose even the world wouldn't contain the books that could be written. So he's thinking about, you know, write, what am I going to write about Jesus, and how much space do I have, and things like that. It's also clear that he omits the discussion about John the Baptist going to jail that we find in the synoptics, because at one point after he introduces John the Baptist, he at another point just says, this was before John was put in prison. And he says nothing else about John going to prison. So if you didn't know the synoptics, you wouldn't have any idea what he's talking about. So he clearly is aware of the traditions about John going to prison, and he's deliberately omitting them because he assumes you've read about them. You already know the synoptic tradition. So I think it's reasonable to say that and thus that is a big part of why John's gospel is different than the synoptics, is because he's deliberately omitting things that the synoptics contain and that he knows have already been put on record, so he doesn't need to record them. So thus, I think it would be reasonable to propose in John's case that, the, for example, the infancy narratives are not paralleled in John because of John needs to keep his work down to the size of a single scroll, and he wants to cover stuff that the other evangelists did not include, at least primarily stuff the others didn't include. When it comes to Mark, I wouldn't propose this for two reasons. The first reason is Mark is the first gospel. I've tried other viewpoints, like Matthew is the first gospel, and I was compelled by the evidence. No, Mark is just first. And so and, you know, if people want to know why I say that, they can call in and ask. But Mark is the first gospel, and so he's writing before Matthew and Luke, and that means he's not looking at Matthew and Luke and saying, okay, they both got infancy narratives, so I don't need to include one. Whatever Mark's reason for not including an infancy narrative, it's not that he was looking at the other Gospels and trying to save space since they already recorded the infancy narratives. The second reason that I would say this isn't the case for Mark is I think that Mark is a different kind of literature than Matthew and Luke. There is, I think, a strong case that Mark is what was known in Greek as an example of hupomnemata, or to use the Latin term for the same genre, commentarii. What hupomnemata and commentarii were notes. They were not polished. They were not put in good literary order. They were sort of a quickie, here are a bunch of notes about mm-hmm. some subject. And they were often meant to then be taken, including by someone else, and polished and put into good literary arrangement and supplemented and polished and published as finished works. So I think Mark is writing just an initial collection of what you could think of as research notes about Jesus. And it was meant to serve as a basis for later works that would refine it, which is exactly what Matthew and Luke did. They took Mark, they supplemented it, rearranged the order to make it better, polished the language, and published it as later works, which was one of the things people in the ancient world did with the hupomnemata. So I think the reason that Mark doesn't have various features is because it's not meant to be a complete, finished biography of Jesus. It's basically a collection of research notes.
There we go, Ryan. I hope that was helpful to you. I'm going to continue on, however, Ryan, because all the lines are full now. Todd is in Knoxville, Tennessee, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Todd, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Very well.
Okay. First of all, Si, I want to say I'm excited. I haven't gotten your book yet, but your book might be the most important in the Catholic Answers Library.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's my name's on it, but it's Steve Dawson's ideas. Yes. So I hope you will find it important and helpful.
Jimmy, my question is, how does the author of John know what Jesus prayed in chapter 17 in Jesus' discourse when he prays to God the Father? How does the author of John actually know what was said?
Well, he was there. One of the things that the author of John's gospel makes clear is he's an eyewitness. He refers to himself as the disciple that Jesus loved, and he makes it clear that he was there at the Last Supper. He records an incident where when Jesus has predicted that one of the 12 is going to betray him, Peter nudges the beloved disciple and says, "Ask him who he means." And so the beloved disciple then relays the question to Jesus, and Jesus indicates he's talking about Judas. So the beloved disciple then reveals himself at the end of the gospel as the author of the gospel. So the end of the gospel says the beloved disciple who had lain with his head close to Jesus's chest was the author. That incident of him laying with his head close to the chest, because they basically ate laying down on their sides. They didn't sit on chairs like we do. That is at the Last Supper, and Jesus makes the high priestly prayer of John 17 after the Last Supper. And so we know that the beloved disciple was there. Now, that doesn't mean the beloved disciple is using like a courtroom transcript of Jesus's words. We have good evidence that he used the literary device of paraphrase to better bring out the message of Jesus. But in terms of the basics of this situation, the beloved disciple was right there. He was an eyewitness of the, of these events.
Okay, Todd?
Okay, because it made it seem like it was a separate prayer, like he was off from them when he said it. I guess that's where my confusion came in.
Yeah, that wouldn't seem to be the case. If you look in John 17, and you back up just a little bit, and at the beginning, it says, when Jesus had spoken these words, he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, and if you then back up to the previous chapter, Jesus is talking to the disciples. He says, "Now do you believe?" So he's talking to the disciples. And it says, then when he'd spoken these words, he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said the high priestly prayer. So the other disciples are right there when he gives that prayer.
I'm going to leave it there, Todd, because as I said, all the lines are full, as happens when Jimmy is here. And I'm going to head down to Austin, Texas, where Caesar is waiting patiently. Thank you for waiting, Caesar. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, how's it going? I'll jump right into it.
Thank you.
Y'all have said that in Islam, they worship the same God that we do. And I can follow the reasoning, and I tend to agree. But by that same reasoning, couldn't we also say that Freemasons worship the same God that we do, the uncaused cause of the world, the universe, the creator, whom they called the grand architect of the universe? Now, in both cases, they acknowledge there's one creator of the universe who is, you know, the uncaused cause, but we draw a line between Islam and Freemasonry. How is it that we say that Islam worships the same God as us? They reject the Trinity. It's not the same, but it's the one creator. But we say Freemasons don't.
Who says that?
They are basically. Do we? I was under the impression that we believe that Freemasons are basically worshiping the devil.
Well, some people may claim that, and some Freemasons may do that, but that does not seem to be the general pattern of activity in Masonic circles. The church does not have a teaching on this. What the church does have is a teaching that Muslims do worship the same God. At least they don't understand him fully correctly, but they are directing their prayers to creator@universe.com, so to speak. And God knows they're praying to him as the creator. Well, the church has documents indicating that Freemasonry, especially in its historic forms, is bad, and that it may be doing the work of the devil and stuff like that. But then you could say that about, you know, all kinds of people who do bad stuff. The church does not have a teaching addressing whether Masons direct their prayers to God. And so we have to do the best we can philosophically to figure out the answer to that question. And I would say it's probably going to depend on which group of Masons you're talking about. Here in America, Masonry takes a different form than it does in various European contexts and in the Latin American context. But here in America, a lot of Freemasons just consider it a kind of self-improvement social club, and they even invite Catholics to join, and lots of Protestants are members of it, and they definitely understand the grand, so-called grand architect of the universe as God. You know, they would say, yeah, when I go to the lodge, we use the term grand architect of the universe, but I'm talking about the creator and I'm talking about God. And since they're Christian, they would say, I'm talking about the Christian God. So I would say, unless they're adding something to their understanding of God that would exclude the true creator, like when I talk to the grand architect of the universe, I'm talking to a God who is not the God of the Bible, then they're talking to a real entity, namely the one true God that exists for everybody, and God will know they're talking to him. They're just using the title Grand Architect of the Universe, which is not in and of itself a bad title, because God is grand, and he's the architect of the universe. Now, there also can be another problem, which is that the devil sometimes can trick people into relating to him when they don't realize it. I mean, St. Paul says that the devil disguises himself as an angel of light. Well, the devil could try to disguise himself as God, too. And so if someone were to show me Masonic rituals that imply that the grand architect of the universe is also the devil, we'd have to take account of this possibility as well. But again, it's going to depend on which Masons you're talking about, because they don't all use the same rituals. And for many Masons, they consciously identify the grand architect of the universe that they mention at the lodge as the same deity that they worship when they go to their, you know, evangelical or fundamentalist church on Sunday.
You know what? I got to leave it there because we got to take a break. We'll come right back and continue. Jimmy Akin, our guest, 888-318-7884, our number.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. And you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Human beings are God's greatest masterpiece. Every person is made in the image and likeness of God. But every saint, that is, every person who accepts God's invitation, his upward call to make them holy. And so every story presents us with a unique masterpiece that God is writing.
The Journey Home, Monday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I started out saying it was Bible questions for Jimmy Akin, so we've had lots of Bible questions, and certainly Bible questions are welcome, but we've opened it up to ask me anything. If you've got a question, Whoever you are, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Hannah is in Tennessee watching on YouTube, and I'm going to say Gallatin. I have not heard the name of the town before, Hannah. How did I do? Gallatin?
That's perfect. Yeah, you're right.
Thank you for your encouraging words, Hannah. All right, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right, so this is just a Bible question, because I have 1,000 others, but
okay.
This is a Bible question. We're going to go with, I started Bible in a Year with Father Mike Schmidt, and something really caught me off guard with Genesis 9. It's about Shem, Japheth, and Ham, and pretty much he said that theologists believe that Ham actually slept with his own mother while Noah was drunk. And I had never put that two and two together. And it explained, Father Mike Schmitz explained it to be like in Leviticus, I think 18 maybe. But if that were the case, what do the two brothers represent when they said that they covered him up?
Okay, I'll answer the question as posed first, and then I'll back up to provide a little more context on the overall issue. So the question as posed was, what do Shem and Japheth represent if Ham if Ham's gossiping about seeing his father's nakedness means that Ham was gossiping about sleeping with his mother? In order to have sex with someone, and so this presupposes the theory that you just mentioned, that that's what Ham was really doing. So in order to have sex, people typically get naked. And so so Ham would have been au naturel with his Noah's wife. And since the text in Genesis says Ham and Japheth walked backwards and covered up their father's nakedness with a blanket, that would be what the text would represent them as doing. If the wife is the father's nakedness in this passage, then, well, they would have taken a blanket and walked backwards so they didn't see the nakedness and covered up their mother, or covered up Noah's wife. You always got to say that, because back in the ancient world, your father's wife was not always your mother. In any event, that's how I'd interpret the text if this interpretation is correct. But I got to warn you that this is not something I would assume is correct. It has been proposed that that when it talks about Noah's nakedness in this passage, that it is a euphemism for some kind of sexual act. But what that euphemism might be could be any number of things. Now, it's true that later in the Pentateuch, you do have a passage that lists various female relations, most notably a man's wife, as his nakedness. And it talks about, you know, you're not allowed to see this, you know, you're not allowed to sleep with your mother because it's your father's your mother is your father's nakedness. So there is a passage that is like that. And some people have proposed the theory that it sounds like you heard about on this podcast, but that's not the only violation. There are other violations that are all sexual violations that are also described as uncovering someone's nakedness. In fact, that's the language that's used in that passage. It's not seeing someone's nakedness. It's uncovering their nakedness. Another proposal that some have made regarding this passage, and I'm not sure if I'm going to figure out a delicate way to say this, but basically that Ham homosexually raped his father. And that's been another proposal that's been made. However, other scholars are not convinced by either of these. And nakedness was something that, broadly speaking, was considered shameful. And there's no need to resort to these sex act interpretations when you could just take the text at face value and say, yeah, he saw his father lying naked in his tent and he gossiped about it. And then Ham and Japheth walked backwards to cover up their father, so he wouldn't be lying around naked in the tent for family members to see. And that's all that's going on in this passage. So you have a range of different views about what it was specifically that Ham did. It could have been a sexual violation that the text is being delicate about. It also could just be straightforward and mean exactly what it says. So I'm not at a point of saying, and I recently actually looked into this subject again, and the evidence to me doesn't seem to demand any single interpretation of this. So I think the passage can be taken multiple ways, including the straightforward way. And I wouldn't insist that anybody adopt any one of these views. So I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, that helps a lot. Can I ask one more quick question? And it was on here because we had just talked about the Nephilim, but as I'm reading the flood situation, it seems to be that he flooded the earth due to, you know, the evil ways of the earth, meaning the Nephilim, you know, the angels were having sex with the women, and then he had to flood the earth. So I don't know. It seems odd to me that I see the Nephilim again after the flood. So were they not all, like, was Noah's or any of Noah's relatives Nephilim that were on the boat that have like passed on that generation? Because I thought they were all killed in the flood.
So first I need to sketch the view that you're entertaining here, which I actually think is the correct one. There have been people who have argued that, so we've got in Genesis 6, we've got three groups of people, the sons of God, the daughters of men, and the Nephilim. And the best reading of the text would suggest that the Nephilim are the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men. Also, the best evidence indicates that the Nephilim are giants. That's actually what the word Nephilim means in Aramaic, is giants. You sometimes hear it said to mean fallen ones or something like that, but it's not spelled the right way in Hebrew for that. This seems to be it seems to mean giants, which is confirmed in our other earliest sources. Now, many people have tried to argue that the sons of God in this passage are humans of one kind or another, but all of those theories are late. And all of our early documents, both Jewish and Christian, interpret the sons of God as angelic beings. And so, and I think the book of Jude in particular confirms that that's what's being talked about in this passage. You can check out the latest episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World for a discussion of that. So the view that you're interacting with proposes that angels mated with humans and they gave birth to giants. I think that is the correct interpretation of what the author of Genesis is envisioning. That's a separate question than how literally are we supposed to take this. But the specific thing you're asking about is, if the flood wipes everybody out, how do we get Nephilim on the earth later? And there is an answer to that Genesis itself actually gives us. First, though, I would mention that at least in later Jewish and Christian literature, it's not the mating with the women that brings about the flood. Instead, in addition to mating with the women, the sons of God also teach humans various problematic practices, like how to forge weapons and how to make makeup so women can seduce men, and how to do astrology and how to do magic and things like that. So the sons of God end up teaching men wicked skills that then cause mankind to become wicked, and that leads to the flood. Okay, how did the Nephilim get here after the flood? Genesis tells us when the sons of God went in to the daughters of men. That's how they got there the first time, and that's how they got there after the flood. It was because the sons of God did the same thing after the flood that they did before the flood. Take a look at Genesis 6, read it again, and I think you'll see what I mean.
Hannah, thank you very much. It's nice to hear from you again. We hope you will continue to call. And we got to take a quick break. So if you're on the line, hang on the line. We're going to get to you when we come back. If you're not, there's two lines open. Perfect time to call. 888-318-7884.